We are all children of this universe. Not just Earth, or Mars, or this system, but the whole grand fireworks. And if we are interested in Mars at all, it is only because we wonder over our past and worry terribly about our possible future. You are listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Hello, and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show, heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Professor Dave, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Centre for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University in London, Ontario, Canada. Today's opening quote is from Ray Bradbury's Mars and the Mind of Man, from 1973. Some people think that Mars is a dead world, but we are nonetheless driven to study it, observe it, and wonder if we might one day visit it in person. The more we learn, the more we want to explore, because it is anything but understood. There are many questions surrounding the issue of water on Mars, and the evolution of Mars. Do we want to search for life, past or present, on Mars? Or should we just search for water? Or is it enough to just explore and find what we find? And if we want to learn more, are we doing enough? To tell us a little bit about Mars exploration and discovery, our guest today is Tanya Harrison from Western University's CPSX, who has been involved in various Mars missions and has studied many different aspects of Mars. Enjoy the interview by Dr. Alyssa Gilbert.
Well, thanks, Tanya, for being on Western Worlds with us today. So you're a PhD candidate here at Western with the CPSX. Now, before you came here, you were involved with a couple space missions. So I was wondering if you could maybe start off by telling us what you did before you got here and what you were doing with those missions.
I worked in mission operations for the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter and the Mars Science Laboratory Rover, which is more affectionately known as Curiosity. For Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, or MRO, I did targeting for the context camera, or CTX, which basically meant my job was to take pictures of Mars every day. I think that's pretty much the coolest job you could ever ask for. And for MARSI, the Mars Color Imager, since it does global mosaics every day, it doesn't require any targeting, but you still need someone to look at the pictures and see what's going on. So my job was to write weather reports almost each week to keep track of the weather for targeting for CTX and to give to the rover planners for Spirit and Opportunity the previous Mars rovers and for planning landing sites for Curiosity in the future.
When people think about weather on Mars, mostly they come up with dust storms, right? So yeah. Is that basically what happens on Mars, or are there other weather things going on too?
There's a lot more that goes on. It's a pretty active place, which I think would surprise a lot of people. I think other than dust storms, people probably imagine Mars as a pretty dead place, but it has seasons just like the Earth, and it has polar caps that grow and shrink with the seasons, again, like we see on the Earth. These changes in the polar caps cause a lot of weather along the edges. All of the moisture that's in the atmosphere on Mars is too thin to hold it, so it has to go somewhere. And in the winter, that ends up being deposited as frost around the polar caps. And in the summertime, it tends to condense out around the equator in the form of water ice clouds. So you have to take into account targeting things around where you have water ice clouds, but the thermal gradients generated when you do have ice being deposited in different places causes a lot of dust activity as well. And that's typically when you tend to get the dust storms that everybody hears about on Mars.
And that ice that's deposited, is it water ice or is it something else?
It's carbon dioxide ice. Okay. So the northern polar cap is made predominantly of water ice, and the southern polar cap is predominantly carbon dioxide ice. Hmm. So you get frost of both types, but in general it's mostly carbon dioxide.
you know, often we go into classes and talk about searching for water on Mars. So I assume you're very convinced that there is water on Mars, right? So what do you tell people who are questioning whether there's water on Mars or not?
Generally, I like to use a figure of just a picture of Mars that you can see even through a telescope in your backyard, where you can see the polar caps and draw a big arrow on it that says ice, so that people understand there is water on Mars. I think the question most people care about is there liquid water on Mars today?
Right.
But there's definitely a lot of water there. And it's thought that if we melted all of the ice that's there today, you could cover the entire planet in about 600 feet of water.
Oh, really? Wow. And that's really a big misconception, isn't it, right?
Yeah, definitely.
A lot of people are questioning even if there is water there, but people usually don't think about it in terms of ice and instead of liquid. So now you're here at Western, so do you want to tell us a little bit about what you're doing with your research here?
Before I came here, I basically did research on whatever I thought was interesting at the time, because I got to look at so much data from Mars that each week it seemed like, oh, look at this, look at this, look at this. It's hard to focus on any one thing. Mostly I focus on different types of mass movement processes, so things like landslides, avalanches, the interaction with crater ejecta as it moves across the surface, any type of generally gravity-induced flows. But I've also done work on volcanic processes and glaciology. So my goal at the moment is to document the locations of all the gullies on Mars using CTX data, which is really high resolution and has covered over 80% of the planet at this point at 6 meters per pixel, which is unprecedented for any other planet besides maybe the Moon as far as coverage that we have right now. And I've documented over 5,500 different locations that have gullies on Mars, and from this I'm hoping to be able to figure out how they form, because it's a bit of a mystery. They appear to be very geologically young and carved by water, but liquid water hasn't been stable on the surface of Mars any time in the recent past, so being able to explain how you have really young water-carved channels on the surface is a little bit difficult.
Okay, what do you mean by young? What's young on Mars, I guess?
Depends on who you ask. Generally, we're talking probably in the millions of years time range, which in geological terms is really young, as opposed to, you know, hundreds of millions or billions of years. So it's definitely not something that is necessarily particularly recent in terms of how people might think of it, although we have seen activity within gully channels that has occurred within the last decade. If that's being caused by the same thing that formed the gullies in the first place, that's also really intriguing, because that means there's water flowing on the surface of Mars today. It's still up for debate at the moment as to, is this actually the gully forming process that's causing this stuff to be discharged from these channels, or is it just avalanches that are happening in these channels of dry material or material that's been lubricated with frost in the wintertime?
So is there any question about how the gullies are formed themselves, or do we know that that's for sure formed by liquid water flow?
When they were first discovered back in 1997 with the Mars Global Survey spacecraft, there was a lot of debate because of the fact that they look so young. And so people that discovered them, Mike Malin and Ken Edgett, proposed that they were carved by water because they do look like water-carved channels. But a lot of other people jumped up and said, well, wait, how do you have water on Mars in the recent past? So they had proposed ideas, some of them not so crazy, like dry mass movement processes or carbon dioxide flows. But as time went on and people looked at the morphology more, it became harder and harder to explain what you were seeing with anything other than a liquid that has the properties of water. And so at this point, it's pretty much generally accepted by the community that they were carved by water.
You were talking about how water isn't stable on Mars, liquid water isn't stable on Mars now, but you said that it was, you know, in the past. So at what point in the past of Mars was it stable on the surface?
That's also up for debate. Mars tends to go through really large swings in obliquity, and so the tilt that it has with respect to the sun changes quite a bit, and that changes how the atmosphere behaves, how the polar caps behave, and where you could have ice deposited and where it could be melting. That could account for small amounts of liquid water on the surface within the last few, hundreds of millions of years. But when you're talking about large quantities, like the amounts required to carve the giant channels that we see on the surface, that's more in the range of 3.5 to 4 billion years ago. And that was probably at a time when Mars still had a thicker atmosphere and magnetic fields. Mars is only a third of the size of the Earth, and so its core solidified much more quickly than ours will, as, we still have a magnetic field on the Earth. Since the core on Mars is thought to be solid, it doesn't have any detectable magnetic field at all, and so the solar wind was able to essentially blow the atmosphere away. And without the atmosphere, the pressure is so low on the surface that water just isn't stable at the moment.
So you've been studying Mars for quite some time, right? Because, of course, you did it with it when you were working on the space missions, MRO, and Curiosity, and now here. What has motivated you to study Mars? What makes it so interesting to you?
I think what got me interested in Mars was the Pathfinder mission, which landed when I was in about junior high or so. And seeing the images of this little tiny rover driving around on the surface of Mars was really exciting. It was cool to think that we could put a robot on another planet and tell it what to do. A couple years after that, NASA came out with the Mars Millennium Project, which was a project for students to design a colony on Mars for the year 2030. And I got really into that project and spent a lot of time on it. And from that, I ended up getting involved with the Mars Society, and they invited me to speak at their international conference in Toronto. And at the time, I think I was about 13. So it was all very exciting in this short span of time to be able to do research and present my research to adults. And I thought it was something that I really wanted to keep up with. But I'd known ever since I was a kid that I was interested in space, growing up watching Star Trek and that sort of thing. But I didn't have a focus on Mars until Sojourner had landed.
But you were still fairly young when you kind of fell in love with Mars, and you said you were in junior high, right? So that's pretty cool that you're kind of achieving your childhood dream, right, of studying Mars.
It was definitely when I got my official NASA badge, there was this feeling of, 12-year-old me would never believe that this was going to happen, so it was pretty amazing.
Very, very cool. I mean, there's been a lot of, obviously, research going on Mars. What do you think has been the most important finding that has come out of the research so far?
I think the most exciting thing is that everywhere we look, there's evidence of water at all sorts of scales. I mean, we look at the surface from the Earth or through Hubble or from orbit, and we can see giant channels that must have been carved with massive amounts of water. And then we landed rovers and landers on the surface and tested the surface materials, and they all show evidence of either being submerged in water or having interacted with groundwater at some point in their history. Or in the case of the Phoenix lander, it actually observed snow and frost on the surface of Mars. So we're finding all of these clues that would be really conducive to life. We just haven't actually found life itself yet.
And what do you think about the possibility of life on Mars? Because, of course, when we think of observing water, we immediately think life, right? And that is one of the major reasons why I would imagine that we're doing so much research on Mars. So what do you think of the possibility of finding some sort of life on Mars or evidence of past life?
I think it's more likely that we would find evidence of past life than finding anything that's alive today. And hopefully where Curiosity landed at the Gale Mound would be a prime place to be able to find that evidence, because you have a 5 kilometer high stack of sediments that might have been deposited in a lake about 4 billion years ago, 3.5 billion years ago, when Mars was likely warmer and wetter and could have supported life. So we might have a better chance of finding it there than we would have had at any of the previous landing sites we've been to. Curiosity isn't designed to find life. It's only designed to look for signs of habitability. So we won't be able to discover life with Curiosity, but maybe we can find some fossils or other evidence that it was there in the past.
And is that one of the reasons for choosing Gale Crater? Was because of the thought that it was probably submerged under a lake at some point?
The final 4 landing sites for Curiosity all showed signs of water. There was a river delta, a crater that looked like it might have interacted with a lake at some point, a really, really old clay sediment kind of material, and then Gale. And Gale is a really big hole in the ground with a whole lot of sedimentary deposits in it. and the type of material that's in it on the Earth tends to be really conducive to preserving biosignatures or signs of life. That was probably one of the key reasons that they decided to pick Gale over the other sites. There's so much material to work with in that 5-kilometer mound as opposed to the other landing sites.
And Curiosity is now on its way to the central mound, right? Is that what it's doing right now?
Right.
Or is it there now?
It's not there yet. It's probably going to take until almost the end of the primary mission before it gets that far, which is actually one of the reasons why Gale was not necessarily the highest on the list to begin with, because of the concerns that if we landed, would we actually make it to the mound by the end of the primary mission.
And what is the end of it scheduled for?
Mid-2014.
But, I mean, we've seen, for example, Spirit and Opportunity, their initial mission was very short, and they've lasted, well, Spirit lasted until, what was it, last year or the year before, and Opportunity's still running.
Yeah,
and they landed in 2004.
Yeah.
Now, hopefully that they'll kind of renew the funding for Curiosity and keep using it and not just let it die. So what is the plan, or that you know of anyway, about what's next for Mars research in terms of sending more missions there?
The long-term goal right now is sample return. So they really want to send a mission to go and collect a sample and cache it, and then another mission later to go and retrieve that sample and bring it back to the Earth. Unfortunately, with all of the funding uncertainties with NASA and the cancellation of some missions like the 2016 orbiter that we were supposed to be launching with the European Space Agency, the future is a little bit uncertain, but sample return is still the main goal as far as NASA's concerned at the moment.
And what about human exploration way in the future? Or do you think that's even a possibility in the nearest future? I know there's the goal of 2030, and there's also a couple private enterprises, right? There's one set for launch for 2018 or something like that.
I have a feeling that 2018 is probably incredibly ambitious, even for a private mission.
But hey, they make no guarantees that you're going to come back. In fact, they pretty much guarantee that you're not, right?
That's true. And that's the hardest part, is getting them back. So if we don't have to get them back, maybe 5 years is okay. The private industry is moving so much faster than the government space programs in any country at this point that they're probably the way to go. And I don't really see NASA having the funding or the impetus to send humans to Mars anytime soon, which is quite heartbreaking, because even as a kid, I thought that I would be able to see humans walk on Mars, maybe even by the age I'm at now. And if you look at the literature that people were writing back in the 60s and 70s during Mariner and Viking, they were telling people then that they could be the astronauts walking on Mars. Even in the 80s, there were plans to send humans to Mars, but it was so incredibly expensive that nothing ever came of it. There's no political motivation like we had with Apollo, you know, to beat someone to get to Mars. I don't think there's a lot of support from a political standpoint. But if we convince private companies that there's some reason to do it, or you have some rich benefactor who would like to do it in the case of these 2018 missions, maybe we'll actually get people to go.
It'll be interesting to see, because I know, you know, it's been talked about since the Apollo days and even before, you know, we're going to get to the moon in the 1960s, and by the 1970s and 80s we'll be at Mars, but clearly that hasn't happened yet. But I think they didn't think about what a huge jump that was, right? It takes 3 days to get to the moon, but it takes at least, what, 8 months to get to Mars?
Yeah.
You know, that's a lot to think about, and that's why they're doing all these studies like the Mars 500 missions and all these other analog missions. Because you have to think about not just the food and stuff, but also the psychology of it, I'm sure, too. I don't know if I'd want to be shoved in a spaceship with 4 other people for 3 years.
No, and I guess this latest call, they were calling for husbands and wives, but that seems like the worst combination, because they're going to get on each other's nerves more quickly than anybody, I'm sure.
They'll probably kill each other before they get to Mars.
Yeah.
If you were to decide which way Mars research would go, what do you think would be the most interesting thing to study in the, say, in the next few years, not thinking down 20 or 30 years, but say the next 4 or 5 years?
I think that Mars research should really actually shift away from the search for life. There's so many announcements that have come out over the last few years that are basically just the same thing over and over again. We found evidence of water, we found evidence of habitability. And the general public is getting kind of sick of it. If you read comments on articles online where they'll announce yet again they found evidence of water, people say, well, didn't we discover this 5 years ago, 10 years ago? And I think we're realizing as we explore the satellites of the outer planets that they're probably the more likely candidates if we want to find evidence of life today. Places like Titan and Europa and Enceladus, where we've seen present-day geologic activity and water spewing out of jets on Enceladus, or lakes made of hydrocarbons on Titan, which are a really good analog for the early Earth. So I feel like if we want to keep searching for life, look out there. And if we want to keep studying Mars, we should start looking at the other reasons why it's interesting just from a geological standpoint, and looking at what can we study on Mars to help us understand the Earth better, because there's definitely a lot that we can learn about our own planet and from Mars as a planet without having to go there specifically to look for water or to look for life.
Okay, well, thanks so much for being on the show, and I'm sure we'll talk to you again.
Great, thanks for having me.
You are listening to Western Worlds on Astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion.
So we just listened to my interview with Tanya Harrison, who is a PhD student here at Western. She talked about her previous experience where she worked on MRO and MSL at NASA, and now she's here studying mostly gullies on the surface of Mars, but other landforms as well. At the end of the interview, we talked about kind of the future of Mars research and where it should be going. So what did you guys think about her opinions that maybe we should not focus so much on searching for life on Mars, but focusing on other aspects that are more scientifically interesting?
I think life has often been the hook. It's like the little green men, the space aliens, right? Even though that's, of course, not what we're ever going to find on Mars. It's vanishingly unlikely to be anything more than microbes, if that. But nonetheless, the existential question seems to be one that still resonates, and so it's been useful. So it's scientifically interesting, but it's also kind of publicity-wise kind of interesting.
Well, and this is what scientists like to write into our grants, right?
Yeah. When
we have to describe how this research is going to impact society, mm-hmm. You know, we need to somehow bring it back to Earth and to the population, general population, and what's the interest. And so, of course, life is the obvious thing.
Mm-hmm.
How did life arise on Mars? That might give us clues on how life arose here.
But, of course, planets, life aside, are legitimately interesting on their own.
Right.
Yeah, and exploring the solar system, regardless of what might be living in it, is a worthwhile thing. But there's a lot of science that, like, you know, basic fundamental research that is valid and valuable research, but doesn't stir the excitement of the public very much.
I think that's true. Like, recently Mars has been around in public's eye as next destination,
mm-hmm.
and a place to find life. Like, other than Mars in the solar system, there are very few places that people expect life. And I think to generate the whole, you know, public coming to the picture, their interest of going to Mars or finding life on Mars. I think that's where most of the money comes from. And also, I think it's her side, being a scientist, it's true that we really should look for everything other than life. But coming from the point where we need money from, as you said, to write grants, we have to connect it to the general population. And as she also mentioned, now not only scientists and governments working with other people, normal businesses are coming into picture as well, trying to send humans to Mars or trying to, you know, mine an asteroid. Hopefully some things will come up and we'll have, you know, finding life somewhere else then. Because now we know that Mars will not have the green aliens.
Mm-hmm.
We will pick some other place.
I mean, in all honesty, though, the life card is the easy way out for us, right?
For sure,
it's the easy way out for scientists. We can say, you know, we can search for life, so that's why you should give us our money. It's harder to convince the general public that there are geologically interesting things going on Mars, mm-hmm. and if we find out more about those types of features on Mars, we can learn about our own planet and other planets. But I think we really need to start trying.
Yeah.
Because we can only last so long on this life card, right?
Yeah.
Like she mentioned a couple times in the interview, you know, the public has heard this story over and over again. We found evidence for water, and they're saying, well, didn't we do that 10 years ago?
One argument I've heard is the idea of comparative planetology, particularly with regards to climate. The idea of planetary climates varying in time is currently in the political consciousness. There's good reason to believe that Venus and Mars had, you know, which are very different from the Earth today in terms of their climate and atmosphere, started more similar to the Earth some billions of years ago. And asking why one of them has gone for a super hot, super thick atmosphere, the other is super cold, super thin, and neither of them hospitable to life as we are comfortable with it here on Earth, is an interesting question. And so understanding the evolution of planets, understanding planets in general, rather than studying only one example, that's one argument I've seen advance. Mm-hmm. I don't know how far it's gotten.
Yeah, well, the idea, right, is to get more than one point on a graph.
Yeah.
Right? So let's take a look at more than one planet to get our information from. And it just makes sense that way, right? If you're going to do any other study, you're not going to take an N equals one study at any value at all.
Yeah.
Right? If you're doing biology or chemistry or anything, this is what we need to hit home, is we need more points on those graphs. And that's another reason really for exoplanet study as well.
I think she also brought up a good point about subsurface of Mars. Because on the surface, Mars looks like a dead planet, like in geologically inactive, but we know very little about its subsurface activity. So I think that's one way we can get public to get excited. Maybe there's some sort of huge cave where there's organism living, or river, where river still flows underground of Mars. And she mentioned about the galleys or something, where they were relatively young compared to other surface features. So I think that would be a good way to encourage public to give support.
Beauty is in the eye of the beholder, right? And
right.
Mars holds a lot of fascination for people who do geology, because it is still active on the surface. And maybe there are not tectonic plates, but there are dunes which are moving around and still some erosion and some new, let's call them mass-wasting features, or gullies. You know, and they're happening, they're geologically young, and there's dust blowing around the planet, so there must be stuff going on. That's pretty exciting. If dust moving around is something that you find exciting.
But you did mention the climate thing, and mm-hmm. she didn't mention it in this interview, but I've heard her speak about her research that she had been doing on the weather on Mars and how the atmosphere on Mars is a much simpler model. There's only, you know, one cell in each hemisphere instead of the three that we have, right? You know, she said it's actually a very interesting model to study because it's a simplified version of our own atmosphere. So mm-hmm. if we can understand Mars's atmosphere, then we'll have a better understanding of our own. So again, this comparative planetology thing comes back into play.
And it's very easy, because with Earth, we know what it's supposed to look like, right? So you can build a model that models Earth fairly well. If you can develop modeling techniques that allow you to build a model that works on an arbitrary planet, then you can be pretty sure that those techniques are robust. And then you can apply them to Earth or Mars and think that you're going to get realistic results. And the idea seems to be gaining some currency, because last year I was at the Canadian Meteorological and Oceanographic Society's annual conference, and they had for the first time a planetary atmospheres session at what is normally talking mostly about the Earth and its atmosphere and oceans.
So they're seeing the value of it.
And one of the things that really impressed me about Tanya's work is that global gully survey. So she's looked at basically every image that ever came back from the CTX camera on MRO. And in the time she spent on it, I mean, she covered basically all the available data. Some over, she said, 83 or so 80, percent
yeah,
of the planet.
Yeah. Over 80%.
And 5,500 sites that have...
Yeah. You know, we talked about single data point studies. This is anything but.
Right.
It's basically a comprehensive global study of all the surface slope features.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very impressive amount of work.
Mm-hmm. And she didn't talk much about the results that she's gained, but she did give a talk recently about it and about how they were all kind of found mostly in the mid-latitude
mm-hmm.
areas, so not near the equator or not near the pole, but kind of in the middle. And really, scientists are pretty much stumped as to why this is occurring and why they face in certain directions in certain areas. I know in her talk she was talking about trying to link it to ice formation, I believe. But again, it was one of these things where it seemed to work in most of the cases, but not so much in the other cases.
And of course, she got to do all of that work as just a byproduct of her actual job, which was like the planet watcher. Right? Let's look at all the data coming down and supervise this planet, which is pretty cool.
So I think it's pretty cool that this is kind of was her dream when she was in grade 7.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
whatever it is.
It was really impressive how she went from, you know, presenting at age 13 to where she is right now, and she has already worked on 2 missions. And, you know, normally people always think, oh, you wouldn't work on, you know, something big or NASA. You have to have a PhD, and, you know, you have to do different things before you actually get to do something over there. But it's not always the case. I know many people who have, you know, bachelor's or master's and are actually assisting engineers there and working for them, working on the actual data. Mm-hmm. So that was really impressive.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. This episode was produced by Parshadi Patel and Michael Forrester and featured an interview by co-host Dr. Alyssa Gilbert. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Raymond Francis, Alyssa Gilbert, Zengi Hu, and Parshadi Patel. Our editors were Alyssa Gilbert and Michael Forrester, and I'm Dave Kirsch. Our theme music is Heliosheath by Sean Kim. You can continue the conversation online and listen to past episodes or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website, www.cpsx.uwo.ca/Western Worlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are @WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are www.facebook.com/Western Worlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope you can join us again next week, right here on astronomy.fm.